This sermon was recorded at Christ Church Mission, a congregation that exists to be a people fully alive in God's kingdom.
I first came to Christ Church when I was in third grade, which was a very, very long time ago now. I was called ma'am yesterday at a party, and I realized how old I am now. But on my very first Sunday at Christ Church, my Sunday school teacher misheard my name and called me Jerry the whole morning, and I never wanted to go back. I hated it. So for those of you whose kids maybe have a hard time going to Sunday school, there's hope they might stick around. Eventually, though, by the time I was in high school, I started making friends. And my closest with the people at the church and my closest relationships with peers and with adults stemmed from Christ Church. These were these relationships at church in small group contexts, and even still today, it is the church and my small group that are the most influential relationships in my life, because we show up to be together, to practice following Jesus and listening to God, to pray and to read the Bible together. And that's the primary way that I experience the presence of God. And so I was thinking about those relationships and the importance of showing up to be together when I read our gospel story about Thomas and his infamous doubt. So this is the first Sunday in a new series. Is it Resurrection Stories or Resurrection Encounters? But it's about this time between Easter and when Jesus ascended into heaven. So he's in his resurrected body, but it is somehow the same and somehow really different. Everybody that he encounters, he appears to people who knew him well, intimately, like one-on-one, but also to crowds and crowds of people. And everybody who witnesses this and sees him after the resurrection is radically changed by their encounter with him. So today, our story is from the Gospel of John, and it begins on Easter night. The disciples heard from Mary Magdalene that morning. You know, she went to the tomb, and it was empty, and then she encounters Jesus, and she comes back and tells them about it, and they're bewildered. Some of them run to the tomb and also find that his body is gone, but none of them have seen Jesus with their own eyes yet. And 10 of the disciples are together that night. So the resurrection happened in the morning. There are 10 of them that gathered together that evening. Judas is dead, and Thomas, for whatever reason, just isn't with them. And the 10 people, the 10 disciples that are there, are totally terrified. They're afraid that the people who just killed Jesus are going to come after them next. And so they're hiding behind these locked, maybe even barricaded doors. They're terrified. And thinking about those disciples that night reminded me of a time that I gathered with friends because we were terrified. And it was on the night of September 11th. I was in college, and, you know, this terrible thing had happened, and we didn't know really what, you know, there wasn't all the information that we have now. We didn't know what was going on, and it was incredibly confusing and scary, and there was so much grief, you know, like that, and that's what I was thinking of, just huddling together with my church friends. We met outside of a building on campus and just prayed and cried. We were confused and grieved, and then the natural response to that was to show up and be together, to be together and experience it together. And I wonder if that's what the disciples were feeling. They didn't have a framework for what had happened either, other than that the man they thought was the Messiah had just been murdered before them. They didn't understand the meaning of his sacrificial death, and they didn't know that Easter had come. They were just together, deeply grieved and burdened and very much afraid. And all of them showed up except for one. Maybe Thomas didn't want to be there. Maybe he was so brokenhearted that he couldn't be there. Maybe he wasn't afraid like they were. Maybe he was just angry and ready to confront anybody that came across him. We don't know. We don't know why he wasn't there, but he wasn't, and he missed out on something really incredible. That night, in that locked room, Jesus appeared to those 10 disciples gathered there. And our small group kind of had fun this week imagining how maybe Jesus appeared, like Star Trek style, where he just like materializes in the middle of the room. Maybe he walked through a wall. I kind of like to picture, you know, like they're really on edge, and so they're just watching the door, and then all of a sudden, like, it just starts to open, and they're just terrified. Whatever it was, they were totally freaked out. It must have just been going crazy. You know, they just must have been beside themselves. They're already on edge, and then all of a sudden, you know how a voice can just, like, startle you so much when you're not expecting it? And so the very first thing Jesus says is this common greeting, peace be with you. And that word peace actually is the word shalom. And it means a deep and abiding wholeness, a deep sense of peace, a deep sense of well-being, peace. And in those words, they realize that it's Jesus and that they are safe with him. Peace be with you. I kind of imagine him saying it the way I say it in the middle of the night when I'm entering a child, one of my kids' dark rooms, you know, and they're crying, hey, it's okay, I'm here, shh, you're okay. Shalom, peace be with you. And now they freak out for a whole different reason, because Jesus is alive. It's Jesus. Can you even imagine the roller coaster of emotions those disciples had been on in the last week? All of their hopes for themselves had been, and for not just themselves, but for their families, their friends, their nation, their religion, all of their hopes had been pinned on Jesus, and they just watched him be crucified, brutally murdered in a humiliating way. He was defeated. And in that moment, they also felt defeated. He was proven wrong, and they were proven wrong. And on top of all that, in the hour of his death, most of them had been proven cowards. They must have been so ashamed to be at their own failure and to become face to face with him again. Of all the things that they could have expected Jesus to say to them, you unbelieving cowards, you traitors. Instead, peace be with you. Peace. Peace and grace. Jesus never speaks words just to shame us. Even when he comes into the darkest corners of our hearts or minds or habits, he doesn't speak shaming words. Even when he's correcting us, he's not shaming us. He speaks grace and peace. He speaks shalom. And for whatever reason, Thomas wasn't with them when Jesus appeared in the room that Easter night. And then, rather than believe his 10 best friends who tell him, you know, what they've witnessed, Thomas declares, I will not believe unless I see it for myself, unless I see his wounds and touch his side. And we really don't know what motivated him to say that, but I can think of maybe three ways that we could read it and relate to it, to his unbelief. And one, and I think the primary one that we usually talk about, is just an obstinance. This, he's angry that he missed out. It's an obstinate unbelief. How come you get to see Jesus and I don't? I'm mad it's not happening for me the way it happened for you. I have to see this for myself. And maybe that's something that we think, well, of course I'd believe if God would have done for me what he did for you, if he intervened for me in that same way, I would have no problem believing. Unless Jesus does for me what he did for you, I won't believe. And I can relate to that kind of unbelief, that kind of doubt. Or maybe it was a genuine skepticism. What do you mean? You guys hadn't slept. You haven't slept for a long time. Maybe this is exhaustion speaking. Were you drinking? This can't be true. This can't be true. I can't even hope that it can be true. It just can't be true. Is this your imagination? Dead people do not come back to life. I can relate to that kind of unbelief, that kind of doubt. Or three, maybe Thomas was just too crushed to keep hoping, too crushed to keep believing. He had given everything he had to Jesus, everything. He had trusted that Jesus was the one, and then he watched Jesus die a brutal death. And he died in the hands of the Romans, but also in the hands of Thomas's religious leaders. Where was he going to go now? Where could he turn now? Everything had been thrown in with Jesus, and he had lost. So can't you just see him saying that, like unable to believe, because he's so broken? And I can relate to that kind of unbelief, that kind of doubt. I can relate to all three of those reasons for unbelief, and I bet that you can too. I've been obstinate in my unbelief. There have been times when I know what is right, and I refuse to do it. And this kind of attitude most often demonstrates itself in my marriage, because you guys, your pastor sometimes, he can say really dumb things. And a lot of times, most of the time, they're not intentionally meant to hurt my feelings. And I know that, but I choose to interpret them as like a deep wrong against me. And there are times when he sincerely apologizes for those things. And I accept this sincere apology, but I really don't change my posture or my attitude toward him. And I do the same thing to God. Like if there's a problem or a person in my life that is difficult, my obstinate unbelief is to just not engage, to just kind of throw up my hands like, I don't know what you're doing there. I'm out. You're not doing this on my terms, and so I don't want any part of it. And I've had genuine skepticism in my faith too, genuine questions and doubts. There are days when I think, are we just making this whole thing up? Is it even real? What are we doing? And I'm not trying to cause trouble or, you know, resist God. I'm just wrestling with everything. For me, some seasons of faith come really easy. It's not hard to see how God is working and moving, and other seasons just feel so flat and pointless, and I'm discouraged. And for me, a lot of times it's not the really great times or the really bad times where I wrestle with this genuine doubt, but like the in-between, just like the long, persistent, repetitive chores and fights, or the long, terrible winter that we had. I wrestle with unbelief and am struck with questions that I thought I'd settled a long time ago. And I've been too crushed to believe before too, so broken and desperate that I just couldn't believe. I just couldn't keep hoping in something. The most recent time this happened was last April. Most of you know my brother-in-law, who was 30 at the time, had a sudden cardiac arrest. And there was this time between when he was given CPR and shocked back to life. It was probably about 5 days where he's on life support and he just wasn't waking up the way that he was supposed to be waking up. And it looked terrible. And I was too crushed to believe that God could or would intervene. And it wasn't an obstinate unbelief, and it wasn't a genuine skepticism. It was, this is too much to hope. It was a crushing weight of fear and brokenness. And I don't know what kind of unbelief Thomas had that day. I wouldn't be surprised if it was a blend of all of those and in varying degrees depending on the hour. But no matter the kind of doubts that we have, no matter the kinds of doubts that Thomas had, the response and the remedy is the same. Thomas kept showing up. He was there the next time his community gathered. Whether he was obstinate or genuine or broken, he showed up. He was there, and not only was he just present among them, but he told them exactly how he felt. He was so honest about his doubt and his needs. And his community didn't push him away because of that doubt and honesty. They kept him close in their circle. In some ways, I would say, they even believed for him. They believed what he could not. And I think that's one of the most simple things we can learn from this story. Keep showing up. Stay in community. Stay up, stay in community, show up with people who believe. When we're obstinate, when we're in genuine doubt and skepticism, and when we are brokenhearted, show up, stay in community. And when we find ourselves like the other 10 disciples, full of faith and believing, show up, stay in community, show up and be honest. Whether we're Thomas or the 10, we have to stay committed to each other. And we can trust that Jesus will do the rest. Thomas kept showing up, and a whole week later, Jesus appears to them again in the same way. And he says the same thing, shalom, peace be with you. He speaks shalom to that whole group, but then he turns to Thomas. He looks at Thomas, and he has a special word for Thomas. See and touch. Can you imagine what Thomas must have felt in that moment? How did Jesus know what I said? How does he know what I required? Jesus heard Thomas when Thomas thought that Jesus was nowhere near. When Thomas believed he had missed out, Jesus was actually there. And I think at this point, Jesus probably could have said anything to Thomas, and he would have believed. You had me at shalom, Jesus. But Jesus, in the context of his community, does something specific for Thomas. He speaks to Thomas in a way that makes him feel seen and known intimately. See, Thomas. Touch here, Thomas. I see you. I know you. I hear you. And can't you just see how that would increase the faith of the whole group? Because Thomas had shared his doubts, what he needed, because he was honest with them, each of those disciples heard Thomas say that. And each of those disciples heard Jesus' response to Thomas. It encouraged not just Thomas, but every single one of them. And Jesus does not stop with Thomas. Jesus hears you, and he sees you, and he knows you. I was reminded of a time when I felt really seen and known by God, and it was probably the time that I felt most vulnerable in my whole life, and it was leading up to the birth of our son, Winston, whom we adopted, and by this time, we had developed a great relationship. We still have a great relationship with his birth family, and so I was in the room when Winston was born, and then we were given a hospital room next door to his birth parents. And so Winston spent some time with us, but he spent most of the time with his birth family in the hospital. There was this 48 hours where he was our son, but he wasn't our son because no papers had been signed, and we just knew that, you know, if she decided to raise him, decided not to sign those papers, that we'd be left without him, and we would also have to bless her decision because we loved her at this point, we loved him at this point. And it was agonizing. Those 48 hours were so hard. And Winston, he was born on a Friday night, and on Sunday morning, We were still in the hospital. No papers had been signed. And I got this text from my friend, Donna, that said, "We're at church. I'm at church. We're singing, 'Oh, love that will not let me go.' And I'm thinking of you guys and crying." And that song, I do this weird thing that Dean always makes fun of me for, where I listen to a song on repeat, like not an album, just like one song. And I really do it. A lot of times it's like some type of hymn or something when I am really struggling. And I was really struggling in those seasons of infertility and leading up to the adoption. And that song, "Oh Love That Will Not Let Me Go," was the one that I had been listening to on repeat. This was the song that Jesus knew I needed to hear. It says, "Oh love that will not let me go, I rest my weary soul in thee. Oh joy that seekest me through pain, I cannot close my heart to thee. I trace the rainbow through the rain and feel the promise is not vain, that morn shall tearless be." That was my song, and Jesus knew in that moment I needed to hear it. And I didn't even hear it. I just heard someone tell me that they were singing it. But I felt so seen and known in that moment. And my response was like Thomas's: "My Lord and my God, you are here. You see me. You know me. Whether these papers are signed or not, you are here. And you see me and you love me." And Jesus knows what we need. He knew what Thomas needed to believe, and he knows what you need too. But we have got to keep ourselves open to him. We don't need to be afraid to let him into any aspect of our life. We don't have to lock him out because we know he can come in anyway. And he sees and he knows, and he doesn't want to speak words of condemnation, but he wants to speak words of shalom. Even in his corrections, he speaks words of shalom. Thomas's bold declaration that Jesus is, in fact, Lord and God is the whole reason that John wrote this gospel in the first place. This is the pinnacle of the gospel. It's all leading to this moment where Thomas says, "My Lord and my God." John tells us that he wants us to look at Jesus, really look at him. If you want to know who God is, look at Jesus. Really look, and you'll find God. That's what happened to Thomas that day when he encountered the resurrected Jesus. Jesus saw Thomas clearly, and for the very first time, Thomas saw Jesus clearly, saw him in all his glory for who he really was: "My Lord and my God." And that same Jesus that heard Thomas is the same Jesus that sees and meets you. The same Jesus that when two or three are gathered, shows up. And like Thomas, one of the best things we can do to experience Jesus is to show up. We aren't going to see Jesus with our eyes or be asked or have him ask us to touch his hands and our side and his side. But we can experience the reality of his presence. And most often, we experience it in community. It's in the words and actions of friends like Donna, who texted me that song, words and actions that our friends who love us and are praying for us and experiencing and practicing hearing from God with us, their words and actions sometimes can feel as if God is speaking to us just as directly as he did to Thomas that day. But it only happens when we keep showing up and make ourselves vulnerable and are honest about our needs and our doubts. It's the only way that it can really happen. Every single one of us is a mixture of this faith and doubt. It's just part of being human, and that's why it's so important to stay connected. Jesus knows that, and he sees it. And he urges us, he doesn't condemn that, but he urges us to look at him and trust him, to believe that he is our shalom and our resurrection, that he is our Lord and our God. Will you all pray with me? Jesus, I want this for our community. We want to know you. We want to experience your love and encouragement through the love and encouragement that we give one another. And I just ask that you unite us, that you help us to all fix our eyes on you together so that we can look at you and worship and know you and know each other in a way that brings your presence, the reality of your presence throughout the world. This world, Jesus, needs your peace, needs your shalom, and you empower us to help bring it about. And so we ask that you do that now, that we can feel you speak shalom over us, speak grace and truth, that we can feel your love and that it flows out of us into the people that we interact with every day. Jesus, we love you and we pray this in your name. Amen.